Hello and welcome back to the Electronic Intifada podcast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. We continue our focus on the health, medical, and humanitarian situation inside Gaza, 25 months into a genocide and under continued siege and blockade. The Gaza government media office stated on November 6th that barely a quarter of the expected and needed aid has entered Gaza since the October 10th ceasefire, confirming, they say, that the occupation continues its policy of strangulation, starvation, humanitarian pressure, and political blackmail against Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Meanwhile, the winter months are approaching, and Israel is still blocking the entry of shelter materials, construction items, and heavy machinery to clear the millions of tons of rubble. Joining us to talk about all of this is Dorotea Guchardo of the medical solidarity organization GLIA. Dorotea, you're back in Gaza, and we're so happy to have you with us again on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thank you, Nora. I'm really happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
So let's get right into it. Tell us where you are, what you've been doing, and the differences that you can explain to us from what you're seeing from when you were last in Gaza more than a year ago and what you're seeing now.
Yeah, sure. So I came in as part of my role as director of development for GLIA. And so I oversee capacity building projects primarily within the healthcare sector. To be honest, I was supposed to come in back in April. So this has been months long in the making, but I was denied. So I reapplied and I was denied again. And that experience was emblematic of the experience of a lot of health workers trying to come in to provide aid, where the Israelis are rejecting about 50% of applicants at any given time. And so I actually hired a lawyer and filed an appeal to request a reason for my denial, because that denial was also a microcosm of the impunity with which Israel breaks international humanitarian law. They're not supposed to obstruct aid nor aid workers. They didn't give me a reason, but they did say, okay, back in September, they said, okay, she can come to the border, be interrogated, and then we'll decide if she can go in. So that's what I did a few weeks ago. I arrived to the border, I was interrogated, and ultimately they decided that I could come in. And so to maximize on my time here, we're really focusing on what projects we can build upon during this period of relative peace. And when I initially came in, it was a complete shock, right? When I was here last, back in spring of 2024, I spent most of my time in Rafah, which is the south of Gaza. At that time, there were about 900,000 displaced Palestinians because they had been pushed from the north to the south due to Israeli violence moving southward. And the city it didn't have the infrastructure to accommodate that level of people, but it was in a way alive, right? There was a lot of life that was happening there. This time we entered through the Karam Abu Salem crossing. We passed on to the Philadelphia corridor. So I got a view of Rafah as I was coming in, or at least what Rafah once was. Rafah is gone. It is completely erased. It is eliminated from the map. And so that was my reintroduction to the Gaza Strip. Both the severity of the occupation in terms of how it's treating the international aid workers, and also the evidence of the destruction that it is causing in the Gaza Strip.
Can you talk a little bit more about what you mean by eliminated from the map? What it actually looks like? You know, Rafah was this, it's an ancient city. It's been there for millennia. And you know, in Gaza, it has been a major city, houses, universities, hospitals, you know, industry, agriculture. Can you talk about what it looks like now?
It's gone. It's gone. It's a combination of rubble that has been cleared away. So the landscape is clear. There's no skyline anymore. And what I did see in place were these compounds that the Israelis had clearly made. What the purpose of those compounds were, I don't know. They were large concrete structures. They were open air. They had a lot of lights, both pointed outward and inward. I don't know what the purpose of them was, and there were at least two that I noted. The population is not in Rafah anymore. The population has been pushed up. We know that the Israelis have taken about 54% of the strip. That includes Rafah, and that includes the eastern side of the Gaza Strip as well. And Rafah and the eastern side were largely agricultural hubs. And so what the Israelis have actually done is they have effectively destroyed the agriculture in Gaza. A lot of people may not be aware of this, but prior to or many years ago and for quite a long time, Gaza had the largest organic agricultural productions in the entire world. They had established a system that made themselves completely self-sustaining. And one of the very first things before they even attacked Anarwa, one of the very first things that the Israelis did was attack the agricultural industry. And now they're holding the best land, the fertile land, where a lot of Palestinians had both private and public farming structures to provide food and sustenance for themselves and for the Gaza Strip. All of that is taken, and Rafah is gone. When we made our way inwards, and as the days have gone by, I've explored a little bit more in the middle area, in Rafah Mouawsi, in Deir al-Balah, in Khan Yunis, I've gone up to Gaza City. And I've been trying to understand and be able to express the level of destruction that we're seeing, the level of... It's sheer annihilation. That is the word that keeps coming to my mind. That it is a strip that has been completely annihilated by the Israelis. And one of the ways that I'm processing it in my head is, to me, it seems very much like a living necropolis. You have the Israelis who have tried to turn the Gaza Strip into this place of death. Every single building is destroyed. Homes, bakeries, supermarkets, neighborhoods, schools, all are completely gone. There is not one area that I have seen from the south to the north of the middle area that has remained untouched by the Israeli violence. Systematic violence, I have to say. It is quite clear that there is a deliberate attempt to destroy every single building. Nothing has been left unscathed. And yet, it's also remaining a place of the living. Right, we have Palestinians who are trying to sustain themselves and their lives under these absolutely terrible and horrific conditions.
And you've also been in the north. There are still attacks, bombings, drone attacks, sniper fire, tank fire in the north, east, and south. And especially in places like Shujaia, north of Gaza City, there is this, vague, very invisible so-called yellow line. And Palestinians who are trying to get back to their what's left of their homes or their belongings in the north of Gaza and eastern Gaza City are being fired upon. Dozens of people have been killed just in the past couple of weeks, despite this, the ceasefire. We need a new word for what this actually is. Talk about what it looks like in the north and especially conditions for people who are trying to prepare for the winter months. As Israel continues to block and prevent any sort of construction materials, heavy machinery, shelter supplies, mm-hmm. tarps, blankets. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would extend the word annihilation to the north. It's completely destroyed. Again, not one building remaining untouched. You have skeletons of buildings where the insides have seemingly been blown out. You have buildings that have been collapsed onto themselves that are almost pancaked onto the street. You have piles of rubble. You don't have recognizable neighborhoods anymore. There's a sense of it, right? Like there's a sense of where streets may have connected, where community may have thrived. Even when you're looking in these buildings, I can see I can see staircases. I can see remnants of a kitchen. I can see a child's bed. And so it's all this evidence of ordinary life that has been completely destroyed. Unfortunately, the level of complete annihilation means that people can't go back. And so there was this triumphant return that we all watched back in the January, quote unquote, ceasefire. Or I'll, you know, and it was joyous watching these Palestinians return back north to their homes after so long of being displaced and under direct fire. We didn't see that this time. And part of the reason for that is because there is no home to go back to. It's totally destroyed. And so there are some people who have gone up to look and realizing, what can we do here? And there are others who decide, you know what, it doesn't matter what's left. I'm going to stake my claim. This is my home. In practice, what this means is that people are setting up tents on rubble, where you can see, you know, big thick blankets being propped up against open walls in order to try to create a makeshift shelter. There are tents inside half destroyed buildings. So I noted one tent 2 days ago on the fifth floor of a partially destroyed building. So it was clear you could go up these stairs, you could go into this tent, but there's no toilet facilities, there's no kitchen, there's no running water, and half of the building is gone. And so to some degree, I suppose they're sheltered up from the top because they're at the very top of the building with the roof over them. But the rest of it is completely open. There's children in there. Right. In addition to the tank firing and the drone firing and the bombs that are still going off, I'm falling asleep every single night to the sound of explosions and machine gun fire. You have children being injured because they're living in these places that are inherently dangerous. And so it's just not a space where anybody can thrive anywhere in the Gaza Strip.
And of course, GLIA is a medical solidarity organization. You work with many physicians inside and out of Gaza. Talk about the state of the medical system, if there even is one left, and what you're seeing inside hospitals and clinics.
Yeah, there is a system, and the reason why that system exists is through the sheer preservation of the. Or perseverance, excuse me, of the healthcare staff in Gaza, who, despite deliberate attacks on hospitals, despite the abduction and torture and murder of their colleagues, continue to show up to work every day in order to provide healthcare to the population, and by doing so, maintained a sense of routine, even if it wasn't normal, because none of this is normal. But they kept that system alive, and. I visited several hospitals in the middle area. I went up to Shifa Hospital, which took my breath away in the level of destruction. And there are efforts to rehabilitate each of these sites that have been destroyed. In fact, I was at Nasser a couple of days ago, and they were officially relaunching or officially reopening a dialysis center. I don't know if they were performing dialysis in that building, but that building had been deliberately targeted by the Israelis, which I saw the damage of back in May 2024 when they had withdrawn. They had broken every piece of equipment. They had vandalized the walls, torn down ceilings, and they set the building on fire. And at this point, it has been and is being rehabilitated, at least from the bottom up. And so there's efforts to make these spaces more functional, but they are severely limited by the blockade. The only thing that is going to help the situation most immediately is lifting the brutal military siege that Israel has on the Gaza Strip. When I'm speaking to some medical directors and I'm asking them about resources, like what is actually coming in, what are the things that you might need? One director showed me that he received thousands of glucometer strips, thousands of them, not one glucometer. So he has all of these strips and no device with which to use them. Because they're proprietary, they're supposed to go with a specific device. And to add insult to injury, they were all expired. And these things have like a 10-year shelf life. So even if you think, oh, maybe they were sitting behind in a warehouse And as soon as they were able to be brought in, they were brought in. Those are still devices that are deliberately being brought into the Gaza Strip at the end of their life. It's a farce. In another instance, a director of a hospital was telling me about these dialysis filters that they need in order to adequately perform dialysis on patients. And it's a filter that has multiple components, the most important of which is the actual filter that goes inside this big piece. The filter did not arrive. So they received hundreds of these hard shell type component things, but not the filter to actually perform the dialysis. And yet the Israelis can claim X number of boxes have entered the Gaza Strip, but it is functionally useless. And these are just small things. We're talking about hospitals with equipment that have not been able to be fixed or replaced in at least 2 years, because let's not forget that trying to bring in medical devices even before October 7 was next to nearly impossible. There's no conversations being had with the Israelis right now about bringing large-scale equipment into these hospitals in order to bring them to like full working condition. So the situation is just as bad as it was on October 7, but worse because now they're dealing with bombed out, destroyed hospitals.
What about maternity services and women's health in general? What are you hearing from physicians and healthcare workers in that field?
Yeah, maternity services are very similar to what we're seeing in other levels of or in other departments of healthcare. The one significant improvement has been access to baby formula. So once these babies are born, because we know in the summer months there was a period of total blockade and formula wasn't getting in. Even international delegates were trying to basically smuggle in baby formula like it was cocaine in their suitcases to try to bring it into the Gaza Strip, and the Israeli border security was taking it out. So there was a period in the summer where absolutely no baby formula was getting in, and that was highly problematic. Now there's baby formula coming in, but also importantly, there have been efforts to provide teachings on breastfeeding has a lot of benefit, especially in these circumstances versus formula. And in fact, we brought in a delegate who was providing lactation support to nurses who could then teach mothers how to maintain their breast milk during periods of low nutrition and starvation. There's always efforts to combat the scarcity. But again, I have to say, these efforts are bandages until that blockade is lifted.
Can you tell us about some of, you know, you've been going to Gaza for a while. You have, you know, very personal contacts with people that you've met, that you've been working with. Tell us some of the stories of people that you know and you love and you're seeing now for the first time after, you know, a year and a half not being able to get into Gaza until now. Talk about some of the people that you're in touch with and what their lives are like right now.
Mm-hmm. It was really nice to be able to connect with people that I've been blocked from seeing for so long. There was an immediate recognition for me at how much weight a lot of people have lost over the summer. A lot of people look much skinnier. They're more gaunt. They're very tired. There's this feeling of resignation that, and everybody's saying this, like we're relieved that the intensity of the violence has stopped, but we don't believe that this is over. And so, you know, navigating some of those emotions about what this period actually means and what we can expect. And that's part of my role here is to figure out what we can be doing to prepare ourselves for what we're seeing as the inevitable worst. And so I've taken some time to sit and listen to their experiences and their stories about what it has been like over the past year and a half. And, you know, one colleague telling me that for about 2 months in the summertime, he subsisted on a small piece of pita, a little bit of duga, which is like this wheat spice blend, and salt every single day. That's all he had. And he couldn't even dare to dream of having any more because he had a wife, three children, and two parents that he was also living with. And so sitting and giving space to people and providing them an opportunity to share their experiences has been really important, I think, for myself, but also I think for them. A real highlight for me, though, was reconnecting with a child that I had met in May of 2024. So back when I was in Rafah, I spent quite a bit of time at Emirati Maternity Hospital. And the first time that I walked into that hospital, in the middle of the SPICU under the head nurse's desk was this thick blanket folded up and a little baby was sleeping on top of it. And I don't know if it was the unusualness of the circumstance or the fact that I had just had a newborn at home, but I was very drawn to this child. And so I asked, you know, who is this baby and what is he doing here? And it turned out that his mom had given birth to him outside of Kamal Adwan Hospital up north in November of 2023. And this was just before the Israelis were about to besiege the hospital for the first time. And she gave birth to this child and asked the doctor who delivered him, Dr. Yusuf, who told me this story, to take her child with him to the south. Because Dr. Yusuf was evacuating the NICU babies from Kamal Adwan Hospital. And so she thought this might be his best chance for survival. And this is a 21-year-old woman who is giving birth for the very first time. Dr. Yusuf tells me the moment was chaotic. They could hear Israeli tanks rolling in. And so without even a consideration, he said, yes, of course, took that child, put him in an incubator with four other babies, and brought that incubator into the ambulance to bring them south. Now, at that time, he tells me, there were rumors that doctors were being targeted. And so he thought, I'm going to tell the Israelis at this checkpoint, because they had to cross the Netzarim checkpoint to go south, that I'm a paramedic. And so he did that. They passed through. And they made it down to Emirati, where that baby then lived and where I met him. And through the commotion, he realized he didn't know the mother's name. He didn't know the baby's name. There was no time for any of that. And so the hospital director tried to start piecing together who this baby was and who his parents were. Meanwhile, the hospital staff, primarily the head nurse and her young children, who, by the way, themselves were displaced, they were living in a closet in the hospital, named him. They named him Yahya, and they took care of him. So by the time I got there, he had been living in Emirati Hospital for the last about 3 months. I visited him every single day. I was totally enamored with him. Took him outside. Other than the excursion from Kamal Adwan to Emirati, he had never been outside. I took him to get his vaccines. Because the Rafah border was open then and I had, was able to exit and enter, I brought him some clothes and some toys. And then in early May, it became clear that the Israelis were going to invade Rafah. And the hospital director, Dr. Mohammed, had a sense of who the parents might be, but he wasn't able to confirm it yet. And so he made the difficult decision to give Yahya to a local orphanage in order to keep him safe. He decided that that was ultimately the best decision and everybody respected him for it. And so Yahya was brought to this orphanage, and the day before Emirati Hospital was evacuated, I took the head nurse, I took her children, we went to that orphanage, we all visited him for what we thought was the very last time. So a few months went by, and Dr. Mohammed confirmed to me that he was able to identify the parents, but they weren't able to reunite Yahya with them because they were up in the north. And the Gaza Strip at this time is still divided by the Netzarim Corridor. So I believe it was ICRC that was able to negotiate with the Israelis to bring Yahya to his parents, and they did so. And then I hear on the media 2 days later, there's a vicious assault in Jabalia, which is where they were located. And then I heard reports that Yahya and his parents were likely killed. A few weeks after that, so now we're looking into the fall of 2024, Dr. Mohammed sends me a message. He says Yahya's alive, and he sends me a picture of him. So I'm relieved. Now, fast forward to now, the first thing I said when I got in here was, I have to visit that baby. I need to see that baby. And so Dr. Mohammed and I visited them, and they're now located in the very north of Gaza City. And in fact, it's their tent on the fifth floor of that building I was referencing earlier. with a completely gutted inside and a totally dangerous environment for an almost 2-year-old now. But it's the best circumstances that they have given the availability of space to live. And I have to say, it was very incredible and very moving, even just to hear Yahya say mama and baba, because his parents were deprived of him for almost a year. And this is just one story. This is one family story in the entirety of the Gaza Strip. Every single person has a story. And the magnitude of the destruction that we're seeing doesn't even equal the magnitude of the experiences that Palestinians have had in Gaza for the last 2 years of this genocide.
That's an unbelievable, heart-crushing story. And yeah, as you said, it's just one of millions and millions, you know, most of which we'll never know, of course. You are you're a mom. You are around kids a lot. How can you assess in your professional and in your personal analysis the level of trauma, especially for children, not just, you know, physical trauma, of course, environmental trauma, but psychological trauma. What are you seeing in the faces of kids and the behavior of kids? And what are you noticing?
The one thing that really takes your breath away when you come to Gaza is the sheer amount of children. You know, you hear about it. You hear that half the population is under the age of 18, so you can conceptualize it. But until you're in this environment where it's literally children everywhere, you don't quite understand what that means. And so you have children of varying ages seemingly taking care of each other, because when most people are living in tents, the structure of their day is dictated by survival. They need to clean their clothes. They need to find food. They need to prepare that food. Well, cleaning clothes and preparing food requires fuel. It requires heat. Many people need to stoke fires. These things take time, right? Collecting the materials and turning them into something that can be used, it takes time. And so a lot of adults are occupied by the daily ritual of just maintaining life. You do see some children out scavenging, collecting water as well. So they're performing more adult-like duties, which is really upsetting because these are kids that have been out of school for 2 years. And so I do wonder what the impacts of the lack of that kind of socialization and routine is going to have on them. That alone, I mean, is a big question mark and a problem. But when you add to that the level of daily trauma of hearing bombs go off, of having friends die, of having parents be killed, it's immeasurable, I think, at this point. It's going to be generational long trauma. And one of the things that actually really struck me about my time before and my time now had to do with children. When I was in Gaza last spring, the skyline was filled with children flying kites. There were kites everywhere, and they were wonderful. They were different colors. They were homemade. Some flew better than others, but there was this relentlessness among kids to get those kites up into the sky. And I remember a few times really being moved by the imagery, because in the background, there would be this plume of smoke because this bomb will have gone off. And then several kites in the foreground, all different colors, their tails just sort of dancing in the sky. And to me, it was kind of a beautiful form of resistance, right? It's these children almost shooting their hands up in the air to say, hey, I'm here. I'm not going anywhere, you know? And it's also a really beautiful juxtaposition between this machinery of death and the innocence of life. And now I haven't seen one. I have not seen one kite in the sky. And the absence of that visual, the absence of that childlike innocence and that childlike resistance from the sky, is deeply upsetting. It's deeply upsetting. And I can't analyze what that means, but I know that it means something, and it's not good, because in the absence of that skyline is just destruction. I know that there are a lot of efforts to work with kids. I can hear there's some school programs during the day. Sometimes I can hear a chorus of children singing. There's a lot of really great, talented, smart people who are doing their best to give these kids some semblance of normalcy and routine and education, combined with some psychosocial support. But it's not enough. It's just pockets of children. So we have a whole generation, an entire population of children that are severely affected by the trauma of the daily violence that the Israelis have inflicted on the Gaza Strip. And the trauma is, to us at the moment, it's immeasurable. When you're only allowed to bring in 15 healthcare workers a week into the Gaza Strip, and you have competing needs like surgery, you know, people needing immediate surgery, it's unfortunate, but psychosocial support tends to fall at the bottom of that list. And so not only do we not have access because Israel arbitrarily decides who can go in and how many people can go in, we also have a hierarchy of needs, of immediate needs, and psychological needs tend to move to the bottom. But I will say, everyone I speak to here recognizes the problem. Every single person I speak to understands that they themselves are going to require some form of therapy, but most certainly that children are going to require a lot of assistance to get through this period and to try to make sense of things and to move on in a healthy way.
Taya, it also strikes me, that healthcare professionals, that medical workers, that psychologists themselves have been holding immeasurable and indescribable trauma as well. I mean, I follow, a lot of doctors and nurses on social media inside Gaza, who, for 2 years straight, they've been forced to witness the most unbearable traumas, physical and psychological traumas, with limited resources, as you were saying, no access to basic medical necessities, anesthesia, mm-hmm. Antibiotics. Can you talk about your colleagues in the healthcare industry, and what they're saying about how they've been forced to endure this while trying to provide for the needs of their community and their families? What does the trauma look like to them?
I think it manifests as fatigue. Everyone is very tired. It's quite clear they're very, very tired. And it's fatigue from overwork. It's fatigue from what they've seen. It's fatigue from the never-ending onslaught that they've experienced for the last 2 years. Similarly to children, trying to put a name to it, trying to explain it, is almost immeasurable at this time because there has been no time to pause. It's been so constant. And even now that there's this ceasefire, quote unquote, I think it's very telling that those same colleagues are the ones who are saying it's not over. And maybe that's their trauma talking, but I think that we also know, based on Israel's behavior, based on the movement that is Zionism, this is not over. And so how do you square that? It's very hard for them to conceptualize a future for themselves, a future for their children, knowing that this is the present reality and not understanding how it's going to possibly end. And so I think that that trauma is manifesting itself in that fatigue and an uncertainty about what even to do about it, other than to just keep doing the same thing, which is to show up to work. And that trauma, that the psychological infliction of this trauma happens at so many different levels, actually. So when I was going up north to go to Gaza City, we traveled up Salah al-Din Road, which is parallel to this quote-unquote yellow line that the Israelis have created, through which, by the way, we can see, you can actually see their outposts. You can see their lights, you can see their Israeli flag, and you know that there's snipers there, like you just know. So there's still this psychological trauma of this kind of surveillance and ever-existing threat that's coming in from the east. As we were going up Salah al-Din Road, and we got to the Netzarim corridor, which used to be the checkpoint area where the Israelis had cut the north off from the south. After the January ceasefire, anybody going north had to have their vehicles scanned. I'm not sure how many people are aware of this, but they had to have their vehicles scanned through a process overseen by American and Egyptian troops. And as we were passing this checkpoint, my male companions that were in the car were telling me how when they had had to pass this checkpoint back in January, as men, they were forced to get out of their vehicles. They had to walk through a dug trench and cross the border. All meanwhile, Egyptian troops, unarmed, are asking them who they are, where they're going, and American soldiers are up on high in this makeshift watchtower outpost thing with machine guns in their hand, observing. And I think about this process, I mean, there's no security rationale to this process. It is designed to humiliate. And that's exactly what they did. They attempted to, and in many cases succeeded, in humiliating these men. It was a dehumanizing process. And that just registers to me as just another example of how many moments of psychological trauma that have existed that aren't just attached to the sound of drones or the sight of bombs or being in one. The level of surveillance in the Gaza Strip that the Israelis have. And then you have these proxy representatives as this emblematic of the complicity between these nations and this occupation is a further level of psychological trauma. And I think to your point about, you know, a lot of stories that we don't even know yet, there's so many of those interactions of experiences of surveillance, of the mercenaries that were supposed to be providing aid through the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. All of these elements that are slightly outside the Israeli government in terms of its direct role in the occupation, all of these things played a very direct role in the psychological torture on all Palestinians in the Gaza Strip.
You know what this sounds like a silly question, but what gives you hope? What keeps you going? What keeps your colleagues going? What is it about Gaza that still, you know, people have this incredible, you know, it's not resilience. It's a steadfastness. It's a stubbornness. It's this deep seated attachment to this land, to this struggle for liberation. But what is it for you that gives you hope in Gaza right now?
I feel like there's two elements to that question, because one is specific to me and the other is specific to Gaza. And It would help to provide the context that I've been overseeing the entry of medical delegations to the Gaza Strip during this genocide since late January 2024. And there's this trend that I end up in my head calling the Gaza phenomenon that has happened with nearly every single delegate, especially those who are coming in from the Western world, who come into Gaza to volunteer, where they come in and they have this almost spiritual revelation. In some cases, it's an actual religious transformation, and some have converted to Islam after they've visited Gaza. But even those who are untouched by theology, and I count myself among them, there is a spiritual transformation that happens when you come here. And I've often wondered what it is, like what is happening where these delegates who come to Gaza, as soon as they leave, they immediately say, I have to go back. I have to go back, despite the risks that are involved. And the only way I can make sense of it is that somebody who's coming in from the Western world, where you have been raised in this culture of individualism, of capitalism, where we commodify literally everything. We commodify our relationships, we commodify our schools, we commodify medicine, everything is commodified. You then are brought into this culture where you're encountering a population that is one of the most systematically misrepresented people in the media, who have been dehumanized by our politicians and by that media. And you're met with instead these people who are very communal, family-oriented, and largely untouched by that capitalistic, individualistic impulse. And when we're outside of Gaza, all we're hearing about are the supposed justifications of Israel's war, that they have this supposed right to self-defense that lends themselves to bombing indiscriminately. We're supposed to be okay with that. And you come into Gaza and you meet with this level of humanity that doesn't square with all the messages that are coming on the outside. So in many instances, you're actually being confronted with a kind of truth that you've never experienced before. It's an unfiltered, unvarnished reality. And it's highly addictive because the basis of the society is relationships. It's honesty, it's integrity, it's dignity, and that is highly addictive. And so it's, to me, it goes beyond just resilience. It's a society that has structured itself to take care of one another despite the odds and despite all efforts to pull them apart. And when you arrive, you are embraced and welcomed as if you are one of them, right? We are all taken care of, despite the minimal amount of resources here. You are offered anything that is available. And it's a level of hospitality and grace that we just really don't get to see anywhere else. And so for me, I think that that's partly what makes Gaza special, is that it's developed into a society of true connection and respect and love. And there is a lot of hope inherent within that. I myself am an inherently pessimistic person, but I have studied quite a bit of history, and I'd like to believe that as painful as this period is, this period will end, and that justice will be had. I don't know if it will be in our lifetimes, but I'm willing to play even the smallest part to ensure that that justice comes, even if it's for somebody else's lifetime.
That resonates so deeply with me, and I know for our audience as well. Finally, tell us how people can get involved with GLIA. Talk about the projects that you're organizing and are putting out there into the world, and for more information.
Yeah. It's really exciting. So GLIA was born in Gaza as a way essentially to get away or get around the imposed blockade. And it was born from the question, can we create devices here? Can we locally manufacture them? And so the answer is yes, through 3D printing primarily. And so we've developed stethoscopes, tourniquets. We're working on an otoscope, but right now we're working on a device called an external fixator that is essentially implanted onto a patient when they have a crush injury on their limb. And it's a really exciting project because it defies boundaries. It defies borders. We understand that the border creates a parameter of what we can do and what we can bring in. The Israeli military can prevent supplies from coming in, but they can't prevent ideas. They can't prevent the sharing of schematics. And so we're working internationally from our Canada office, our Poland office, and we're working with Palestinian surgeons on the ground to co-create this device that meets the specific need of Palestinians inside Gaza. And so this is one of the things that I'm working on now. And we've been able to put it on. So we have a partially 3D printed external fixator that has been designed by Palestinians in Gaza, and they have installed it on our first patient who is healing beautifully. And so we're going to move forward with testing it on another 5 patients and hopefully just keep perfecting the device. So that way there doesn't need to be this reliance on Israel to decide whether a life-saving medical hardware can come in. If anybody wants to learn more about that, they can visit us on our website, which is glia.org. And we're also on Instagram, glia_intl.
Amazing. Again, glia.org. That's glia.org. And on social media as well. Dorotea Guichardo of Glia, thank you for all you do. It's so good to have you back on the Electronic Intifada. Please be safe, and please send our regards and our respect and gratitude to your colleagues there in Gaza. And we'll have you back on very soon. Thank you so much.
I will. Thank you so much for having me.